You ready? That's why he came early.
If we read through the...
Yeah, I'm reading about whatever you feel is going to be the best way to make your presentation.
Okay.
Go on, good job.
This is the fourth chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled The Appearance of Sri Narad. So we're reading from the... Study Guide, Chapter 4, 4 Part 1, Verses Summary. Shaunaka Rishi inquires from Suta Goswami about the history of Sukadev Goswami speaking the Bhagavatam to Maharaj Parikit. Next section is Suta tells how Vedavyas compiled and edited the Vedic literatures for the benefit of the unfortunate souls of Kali Yuga. Third section, even after his great work was complete, Vedavyas still felt dissatisfied. Just as he was contemplating the cause of his despondency, his spiritual master, Narada Muni, appeared. So we could elaborate on the structure of the chapter. The history of Sukadev Goswami speaking the Bhagavatam to Maharaj Parikit. First verse is Shaunaka Rishi, who's the eldest member of the assembly, congratulating Suta. He said to him, Mahabhaga Vadatam, that you are the most fortunate of those who can speak. Not everybody can speak. Not everybody is able to present philosophy. There are people who just study and then they cannot present. There's Acha and there's Pracha. So Suta was able to repeat what he heard from his spiritual master, Sukadeva Goswami. He was able to remember the whole Bhagavatam. We go back then to Sukadev Goswami. They're narrating the history of Sukadev Goswami. When, where, why, where did he come from? Why did he leave home? He was 16 years in the womb of his mother, then appearing perfectly self-realized. He left without performing any samskaras because he didn't want to get caught up in that business. As he was leaving the hermitage of Srila Vyasadeva, he passed a bathing kund, and the girls were bathing there naked. As Sukadeva Goswami went past, they didn't adjust their behavior. But when his father, Vyasadeva, came past, and they quickly covered themselves. And he inquired from them, why have you done like this? And they explained that we can perceive by the mood, the features of Sukadeva Goswami, that he was on that topmost platform, a Paramahamsa. He was completely indifferent to what was going on in the material world. So we did not feel affected by his passing. Whereas you're a grihastha, and you have to discriminate between male and female. So you're caught up in that whole business. So we had to cover ourselves. So Sukadeva Goswami was recognized by the girls who were bathing there. He continued traveling, and he appeared like a deaf and dumb person. He wasn't speaking. He was just absorbed in his meditation. So how was he recognized? He was recognized when he spoke. Just by seeing his outward appearance, he had a beautiful features. He had the same bodily hue as Krishna. But he could not be recognized until he spoke. So this is indicative of how to recognize the great souls. You can't tell by their outward appearance. Although it is said in the 19th chapter of the first canto that the sages, they could recognize the bodily features of Sukadeva Goswami. They were expert in the science of physiognomy, so they could see. Srila Prabhupada, an astrologer, saw his picture, and he made the comment that here is a person that can create a house in which the whole world can live by observing his facial features. So the sages were expert at that. They could see like that, but also to recognize him as a saint, then we have to hear how he spoke. And he met Maharaj Parikshit on the banks of the Ganga. Why was he prepared to stay and discourse? Because normally a sage in such an exalted state of consciousness, he never stays with materialistic people. He'll go and visit a household and stay there just long enough for the cows to be milked, to get some buttermilk, some sustenance, and then he'll go. So Prabhupada makes the point in that purport that the Paramahamsas, they should not become enamored by the wealth, the attributes of the Grihasthas. They should only go there to sanctify their residences. They're begging for that purpose, not begging necessarily to get. If they get something, then that's okay. But the main reason they're going is to benefit the residents. Then in text 9, we hear some of the glories of Parikshit Maharaj. There's three main glories. That within the womb of his mother, he was saved by Lord Krishna. And then as a righteous king, he was prepared to kill Kali when he met Kali in the kingdom. He wasn't just going to make some rule and if it got administered or not. He was prepared to follow through. He was immediately going to dispatch Kali. And finally, that he was cursed by the Brahmana boy to die within 7 days. So he was in a very exalted position that he could prepare within those 7 days to meet with death properly. And then the sages, this is part of these questions here, they ask, he was young, he was capable, he had everything within his grasp, why was he renouncing the kingdom? And even further than that, they describe that he was the shelter for all others. His administration was so perfect that everybody was properly fed, they had enough shelter, and they were following the Dharma. They were following the prescribed rules. So Prabhupada made the point that if people are just doing this, then there shouldn't be any quarrel. There shouldn't be any disturbances. We were in Indonesia, and they artificially raised the price of rice 4 times. And riots broke out because they didn't have enough to eat. On a codicil, the people in Indonesia, they go crazy. They're very much dependent upon their rice. So this was a major disturbance, created riots, just by not having the proper food supply. Maharaj Parikshit, he was a shelter for all others. Why was he preparing to leave his body? This is described in the 19th chapter, the first canon, that he took advantage of the curse to go back to Godhead. This is a higher duty. Give shelter to others, the king, he had to do the job, but he saw the loophole, he saw the way out, so he took advantage of that. Soon. Now we hear about the appearance of Vyasadeva. Vyasadeva, he appeared as the son of Parashara Muni and Satyavati in the last period of the Dwapara Yuga. He was there just at the end. And he was able to assist in the appearance of the Pandavas. He begot the Dhritarashtra, Pandu, and Vidura. So, great sage. He was residing at Samyaprash in Badrik Ashram. And he could perceive the qualities of Kali Yuga, that people would not be able to concentrate for very long. He could see into the future. Prabhupada makes the point that modern day leaders, they can't see 5 minutes into the future. So their plans are just band-aid solutions. Whereas he could understand that people were not capable of a broader understanding. So he concluded that he had to divide the Vedas. As Maharaj was saying last time, that in previous ages, you would just study the Vedas and you would absorb them, you would understand them. But without having strong powers of concentration and long lifespan and other things, then that wasn't possible. So the Vedas were broken up into sections, and then you could extract a certain part from the section that you were reading. And if you understood the principle of that Veda, then you could also apply that to the other Vedas. But even the people of Kali Yuga being more fallen than that, they are more inclined to stories. So Vyasadeva, he compiled the Mahabharata, the Puranas and the Itihasas, the histories. And this was much more suitable for the residents of Kali Yuga. Then these different Vedas were entrusted to different great devotees. They were considered to be the professor of their section of the Vedas. And then they were disseminated through their followers, and this is where knowledge has arisen within the whole society. It's all come from these sources, the original chains of the Vedas. Sutta's father, Sutta Goswami's father, Romaharshana Sutta, he was entrusted with the Mahabharata. So he was presenting that. One aspect of this dividing of the Vedas and the Mahabharata was then that the Bhagavad Gita becomes the essence of all of these scriptures. And we can understand knowledge about devotional service, knowledge of the Vedas, just by studying the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna, he spoke Bhagavad Gita to his friend Arjuna. The Bhagavad Gita is enclosed in the Mahabharata. It's couched in the Mahabharata. There's all stories at the beginning, and it leads up to the focus on the battlefield, and then there's more stories afterwards. So people are inspired by all these stories. And then in the middle, the philosophy is spoken by Krishna himself to Arjuna. And then further in that purport, Prabhupada says that and Mahaprabhu, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he became the greatest exponent, the greatest teacher. Krishna, he spoke in Bhagavad Gita and finished on abandon all varieties of religion and just surrender unto me. And then Lord Chaitanya, he took off from that point to make it even more accessible to the fallen souls in Kali Yuga. Just chant Hare Krishna. So after this point, then we go back to Vyasadev, and he's not feeling satisfied. He was compiling all of the Vedas for the welfare of all of the citizens. But something within his heart, he wasn't completely satisfied. And the next verse says that he couldn't consider it that his job was perfect until he felt that satisfaction. So he started to examine his own consciousness. And he concluded that he'd lost the clue. He Krishna had become absent from the picture. In that process, he checked, just like sometimes we're doing our service or we're on Sankirtan, and that we're not getting the results, so we can go back through a checklist. Did we properly worship our spiritual master? Have we offered proper respect to the Vedas? Have we performed our jagya, our sacrifice, the prescribed sacrifice? And if we can give a tick for all of those things, then we can conclude that there's another cause. So Vyasadeva went through all that, and he then came to the conclusion that he hadn't directly presented Krishna. He hadn't described the glories of devotional service. And then, feeling that vacancy within his heart, that despondency, Krishna arranged for his spiritual master to appear on the scene, Narada Muni. So here is the appearance of Narada Muni. And he, Vyasa, offered him the full respects of Lord Brahma. Lord Brahma was the father of Narada Muni. He was the original teacher of the Vedas. So Narada Muni is offered the same respect. So that's the sequence of the chapter. And then we discover that the seventh question of the sages is asked. And then it's expanded into six different items. Question seven in essential form. O Suta Goswami, may you please relate the pious message of Srimad Bhagavatam as spoken by Srila Sukadeva Goswami. Now this question includes six specific items. When, where, and why was the Bhagavatam recited? From where did Sukadeva's father, Krishna Dvaipayana Vyasadeva, get the inspiration to compile the Bhagavatam? Number three, after wandering about the earth like a naked madman, how was Sukadeva Goswami recognized as the great sage he actually was when he entered Hastinapur? Item four, how did Emperor Parikshit meet Sukadeva Goswami? Five, why did wealthy and powerful Emperor Parikshit renounce his kingdom to fast to death on the bank of the Ganges? And six, Emperor Parikshit did not live to enjoy his wealth and power. He lived to give shelter to his subjects. So why did he give up his body, which was the shelter for others? Now, these items are discussed halfway through this chapter and then all the way through to the end of the first canto. Ongoing descriptions. We have the philosophical significance of question 7 and its six items, which relates to what are we going to do? We have to perform devotional service. The summary is, this Bhagavatam, which contains the direct pastimes of the Lord and which leads the conditioned souls of Kali to engage in pure devotional service, the only activity that will truly satisfy them is effective only when heard from a pure devotee who is representing Sukadeva Goswami. So maybe we can leave it there and open up for discussion.
So it's very natural that when something very significant is going to be discussed, the background behind it is to be known. Because the background many times will shed some light on the application. As we see here is that their questions, much of it is also just, you know, when, where, why. They just want to know what is the purpose of it. There must be some purpose. Everything that's done has a purpose, like that. Every aspect has a purpose. Then where does this inspiration come from? Because if you're going to do something, it has to come from somewhere. As we were discussing in the with Sambandha Abhideya Prayojana, in Sambandha you have desire. From that desire you get need. When there's need, then there's activity. So where did the desire come from? Where did his inspiration? Because that will be founded in the surroundings. Right? Your Sambandha is all your elements that you're dealing with. So what would be the surroundings that caused that to appear? Does that make sense? Because if we look at it, okay, here, Vyasadeva is dissatisfied. So the scriptures aren't going to give you, you know, 5 million different sources of dissatisfaction that you can go through until you find the one that fits you. You know, dissatisfaction that you don't have a car, or you have a car but it's the wrong kind of car, or it's the right car but it's the wrong color, or it's the right color but it's got a scratch on it. You know, I mean, it's just, it's unlimited. So they give something that's very significant from that we ourselves can understand what's happening. Does that make some sense? You know? So here he has performed his duty. His duty happens to be compiling Vedic literatures, right? To make it clear. That's why he's doing it. So he's done it, he's not satisfied. That means his service wasn't properly focused on the Lord. So everybody has a service. Everybody has, therefore, something to connect to Krishna. If there's a lack of satisfaction, means there's something that's not connected. Does that make some sense? So that's why these things are going about. How would you recognize such an elevated person? Because other people you can recognize, they have an attitude. Right? Very easy to tell. This person is powerful or rich or beautiful or something, because they present themselves like that. But how do you find someone who doesn't present themselves like this? What are the symptoms? Because there may be more people like that. We would want to associate with people like that. So how do we understand who such people are? Right? Because here the physiognomy, he was beautiful, but it wasn't just any old beauty. It was specifically, according to Shastra, coming from piety. And it had, you know, all the different, so many of the qualities of Krishna. Now we know this person must be special to get that kind of piety. Does that make sense? Because you can have all kinds of beautiful. Birds are beautiful, animals are beautiful, trees are, a lot of things are beautiful. But to have the beauty that's connected with the Lord, then that means there's something special. I hope, Swami Kiri, I hope. Like that. How did they meet? Because it said that meeting the spiritual master, bona fide spiritual master, the example is given of the, you have the ocean, which is very vast. You have one turtle sitting onto the bottom of the ocean, which is very vast. You have one piece of driftwood floating on the top of this ocean somewhere, and it has a hole in it. And so when the turtle decides it wants to breathe air, it comes up from somewhere on the bottom of the ocean, and as it comes up, it just happens to stick its head through the hole in the driftwood to take its breath. So that's how rare it is to meet the bona fide spiritual master. Right? The Prabhupada's so powerful, the Acharya's so powerful, it seems it is very, very easy, but if you look at how many living entities there are, and that we're, you know, how many devotees have come in contact, then we understand, you know, like that. Then why would he has everything, why would he give it up? Right? You have everything, why would you give it up? Everybody's endeavoring for it. But if he's, and he's advanced, he doesn't need to give it up, because what he has is helping everybody else. Right? So you want to know its application, how to apply these things in your life. I have stuff. You know, the sages are there. They have their kamandalu. You know, they have the little stick that they rest their arm on. You know, so amongst sadhus, they may be considered very opulent. So why would they consider keeping it or renouncing it? He renounced everything. Why? So what is the consideration? So then, from these we see that Maharaj has brought out these summary. We see that here is that one needs a spiritual master, right? Then it's effective. When we hear it from bona fide source, we're hearing here from Sukadeva Goswami, who's, and then we're hearing after that from Sutta Goswami. Then we're hearing through the Acharyas, and then Prabhupada's giving us that. So, therefore it works. Otherwise, so many other people are speaking, it doesn't work. Right? So many people speak Bhagavatam. You should see how many people are at one of these Bhagavatam recitations. I mean, tens of thousands. And guaranteed, any time these professionals sit down, there's 10, 20, 30, 40, 50,000, 100,000. They speak so sweet. They're so intelligent. But no one in that crowd is taking up the process that is given in the Bhagavatam. So that's the point, is that unless it's heard from the bona fide source, it won't work. Then it's describing the devotional service, which is the Lord's pastimes, his name, form, qualities, and pastimes, his interaction with his devotees. Right? So therefore, by approaching that, you can get out of this. Right? Right? That's a very major theme in the Upanishads, is this, that. This, we have the material world. Atra, that, paratra, means is that the supreme, that, you know. So, the pastimes is what is going to get you into the spiritual world. That's very important. The sadhana, the basics, being pure, following principles, regulating our lifestyle, working with intelligence, that will get us out of the material world. But it's engaging in the direct activities. That's all that's actually going to get you out. That's the practical. So that's your application. So your goal is to always be absorbed in the pastimes. You're not going to get that. The inspiration is not going to come up without the spiritual master. And it's not going to happen until there is the direct application. Right? So in other words, we should see in our life, are we hearing from authorities? Do we understand the names, form, and qualities of the Lord is what we're trying to gain? And do we understand that as much as we can, the direct application of this in our life is what we're looking for, right? The chanting, reading, associating with devotees, something that's dealing directly with the Lord, the five main items. These we should see as much as practically as possible. They're very absorbing in our life. So then through this, then we see the sambandha abhideya prayojana, then functions like that. The goal is to be absorbed in the Lord's pastimes. That will be effective and will be inspired when that is coming from bona fide sources, and making the endeavor that that is one of our activities and absorption, then that will make us satisfied, and that will then bring us to that platform. So that would be any comments I would have on it. Something, Maharaj?
Just catching up.
Yeah. So Shanti Prayana Prabhu, he went through and gave the different points and backgrounds from the purports and this and that.
In which chapter?
In chapter 4.
Four.
Yeah, in chapter 4. Here. So then,
So he gave that, and then I just made the comments on the kind of like the why these kind of questions would come up. Why would there be any significance? Why would they ask that kind of question? You know, it's like they're sages. Why would they worry when, where, why? But because you want to apply it in your own life, so you want to see what are the circumstances that others did it in, so you can see what's the principle, so you can take it and practically apply it in your life. And then the points here, the philosophical significance and the summary, then putting those together into the Sambandha Abhideya Prayojana. So that was our comment.
So you've run all the way through this outline?
Yeah, like that. Means the last where the items are answered, then we're accepting that that's where it's happening. He didn't like that. He gave some references, some examples on that. Like that.
Yeah, it's significant that, as it states here, 4.4, Sutta's answer in question 7, of course, carries on until the very end of Srimad Bhagavatam. And there are so many questions like that. So, therefore, in compiling this study guide, I realized, because we started off with the idea, we'll look at questions and answers, but everything in the Bhagavatam is either a question or part of an answer, so you can't leave anything out. And the thing to do, which we try to do in this study guide, is remind those following the course where, even in a chapter where there's no question, what this is part of an answer to something referring back. So you can try to see this when you come to these later chapters 5 and 6. I don't know if I already gave the references or not. Just referring back, I started to be more diligent about that a little later. But keep it in mind. Don't, you know, these references, when you see them, if you really want to learn Bhagavatam and how. See, Bhagavatam, the thing about the Srimad Bhagavatam, unfortunately, and I don't mean to sound like I'm being, critical or undermining any well-established traditions in ISKCON, but I see one difficulty, let's say difficulty or challenge, in this morning by morning, one verse at a time class program. And you all know it too. The tendency is morning by morning, you've forgotten what was spoken the morning before or two mornings before, and you don't keep the thread up. You see, it's almost as if each verse, each morning, is a whole, whole new philosophical adventure in itself, unconnected with anything that went on before or will happen tomorrow. And so what we're trying to do in this course is to let you see how the Bhagavatam is so interconnected, so that what's being spoken or said anywhere in the Bhagavatam is connected with something before that has been asked, and also something that will follow. Something additionally that will follow, that will make this what you're reading right now even more clear, or lead to a further question. But the whole, the Srimad Bhagavatam, 12 cantos, is an intricate entire book with its own internal logic. And that's what we're trying. Of course, the ultimate logic, what is it? When I spoke before, ultimately it comes down to those chatushloki, 4 verses. That's like the sutra. Sutra means code. Sutra in Sanskrit means code. So, like you can have this came to mind. In the Second World War, the Germans developed one of the very first, what we could really call computers. It's called Enigma, a machine, a code machine. And the British Secret Service managed to get, because I think in Poland some underground operators, they managed to steal an Enigma machine and some pages of the code. And so the British set up an intelligence office, and they had their best minds work on this portion of the code. It wasn't a complete code. And they worked it out, they worked it out, they worked it out. Took many, many big brains, long, long time. And they finally broke the code. So this Enigma machine was such that it was, you know, you press one key as if you're typing a message, but another letter would come up. You would say press Y, and instead of that, X would come up. Now, how that would happen, it was all by seeming random chance. It was really a question of one in hundreds of thousands or hundreds of millions of chances that when you press Y, an X would come up. But the British managed to break this, they managed to get the code, the background code, and so they could read all the submarine traffic, the messages being sent by the British, by the German naval headquarters to their U-boats. And so they, in this way, could figure out where all the U-boats were. So Bhagavatam, similarly, 12 cantos, you know, everyone knows, when you read the Bhagavatam, or especially when you hear the morning-by-morning class, it seems like some incredible, almost like in secret language, you know. But if we can understand these, that everything comes down to these four verses, and that is sambandha, that in other words is a presentation of sambandha, avideya, prayojana, and that everything is actually linked up through that by these questions all throughout 12 cantos. Then Srimad Bhagavatam becomes very, very, I think, much more intellectually interesting for us. Because many devotees, they tend to read Srimad, and this is a fact I've observed, they tend to read Srimad Bhagavatam for the stories, you know, because there's lots of nice, it is, after all, one among the Puranas, and the Puranas, if you want to know how the Puranas fit into the rest of the Vedic literature, so there's what's called a Prashtantraya. Think of a triangle, and at the top of the triangle, there's the Shruti Shastra. So that means direct instructions, orders, given by the Lord Himself, or given by Lord Brahma, or given by personified Upanishads, great sages. And then when you have direct instructions, of course, sometimes, often, especially the Vedic instructions, like Prabhupada gives the example that cow stool is pure. So the brain, you know, may not understand that. So therefore, there are two other sides of the triangle. There's Nyaya Prashtan, there's logic. This in the Vedic Shastra is Vedanta Sutra. Or to put it in terms of modern science, like Prabhupada gives an argument. If you examine the constituents, or the ingredients of cow stool, that you find it actually contains all kinds of antiseptic chemicals, which when extracted, you can produce very powerful antiseptic purifying agents with. So this is logic. This is logical proof. And then on the third corner, there's the Smriti Shastra, which are like, if Shruti is like law books, then Smriti is like law journals. You see? In a law journal, there's an actual case. Actual cases are presented. Someone did this crime, listed in the law book under paragraph 3, section 6, subsection 2, you see, specific law. So he broke this law, and he was arrested, and it went to trial, and the judge ordered it. So it becomes like a story, an interesting story. Oh, here's a case from 1927, and this is evidence. In courtrooms, very often, the lawyer is raising his hand, calling for the floor. He's given the floor by the judge, and the lawyer says, I would like to now argue a precedence. It's always called precedence. That there was a case exactly like this one that was tried in Cincinnati, Ohio in 1932, and the accused was found not guilty because of such and such and such and such, and these cases are exactly the same. All the circumstances are exactly the same in this case. So therefore, I argue that this case be dismissed on the basis of precedence. So this is how Smriti works. You have stories, you have examples from the lives of, as we're seeing, we're reading about great personalities. Sukha Goswami, Shaunaka Rishi, Shukadeva Goswami, Chil Vyasadev, Narad Muni will appear soon. And on and finally, the avatars of the Lord will appear. I think you covered that yesterday already. We already began to meet in very brief form the avatars of the Lord, who are the greatest personalities. And there are demigods and there are demons. And so from their interaction, we are actually shown the meaning of Shruti. And even if we're not very good at nyaya, at philosophical argument, back and forth, giving studied reasons why something is right or wrong, we have it illustrated in the Purana. And this is the Mahapurana, Amaoprana, as stated in Bhagavatam itself, and Mahaprabhu, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would refer to it like that. Spotless Purana. In other words, this Srimad Bhagavatam is transcendental. It is Vishuddha Sattva Purana. There are said to be six Puranas in the mode of goodness. Bhagavatam is among them, but among those six, Bhagavatam is the only one which is in Vishuddha Sattva. It is above the ordinary mode of goodness. It is in pure transcendence. And the other five, like Vishnu Purana, are in mode of goodness. Therefore, you see that in the Sri Vaishnava Sampradaya in South India, where the Vishnu Purana is, of course, they respect Bhagavad Purana, but to them, Vishnu Purana is foremost, because they're the objects of worship. The ultimate objects of worship are Lords Lakshmi and Narayan, and in that worship, there is still the scent of motivation of Dharma Artha Kama Moksha. By the grace of Lords Narayan and especially Lakshmi Devi, she has eight forms like Dhana Lakshmi. Maybe you've seen the poster, Dhana Lakshmi, eight forms of Lakshmi. There's one Dhana Lakshmi. There are gold coins springing from her palm, you see, to the faithful devotees. Each one is awarding some kind of material benediction under the direction of the Lord. So in this form of Vaishnavism, they're still interested in getting good progeny and nice Lakshmi. Therefore, Prabhupada said, comparing the two sampradayas, he said, the Sri Sampradaya is noted for their opulent temples and grand style of temple worship, whereas the Brahma Madhva, Gaudiya Vaishnav Sampradaya is noted for grantha, for books. You see, books of knowledge. There are more books of knowledge in this Sampradaya than any others. So this is the wealth we aspire for. This Sambandha Gyan, which then leads to Abhideya, fully absorbed, I'm trying to think of how Prabhupada translates one, Bhutta Bhava Samanvita. So to be fully aware, fully absorbed in one's avidya, the activities of one's devotional service, one is always remembering Krishna, because there's so many items in the Shastra. Not that he's remembering necessarily the pastimes of the Lord in Vrindavan, Krishna playing his flute, seeing the Tribhanga form all the time and everything he does, washing the pots, cooking, cleaning the brass, he's always seeing. In fact, I was told one story of one bhakta many, 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 many years ago in the early days of ISKCON. So he wanted to achieve that platform. So he got one of these harmonica holders, you know. If you remember the folk singer Bob Dylan, he was always known for that harmonica holder, and he'd have his harmonica here. So he could play guitar with both hands and play harmonica like this. So he had a harmonica holder with a picture of Krishna. And so he'd be washing pots or whatever he'd be doing, and always this picture in front of him. But unfortunately, this bhakta soon left the Association of Devotees and returned to Haight Street in San Francisco and began the activities that were famous on that street, that street corner, Haight-Ashbury, the hippie mecca of America in the 1960s. He resumed those activities that are practiced there. So no, not that kind of so-called remembrance of Krishna, but remembrance of Krishna through the Shastra. You see, Shastra Shakshus, seeing everything in terms of the Lord's instruction. Therefore, Puranas are important to us, but especially the Mahapurana, Srimad Bhagavatam, because it is spotless. Because there, the knowledge is illustrated in a way that is free of even the slightest hint of material motivation. That if I do this, you see, just like there are some warnings in the other sattvic Puranas, that I remember reading, I think, in Garuda Purana, which I believe that's also a sattvic Purana. I believe so. So Garuda Purana, there are warnings that if a devotee visits a Buddhist temple, you know, goes inside of a Buddhist temple, then he will go to hell for so many kalpas, because he should never go to the congregational places of atheists. And I remember a godbrother of mine, Gaur Hari, relating, getting back to the early days in San Francisco. Even before there was a temple, Prabhupada was moving about, being conducted by his close followers, who were more or less disciples, were becoming disciples. And they took him to one so-called spiritual gathering. You can imagine what that meant. All kinds of very strange characters with very strange hairstyles and beard styles. And there was also some Buddhists. And Gaur Hari remembers how Prabhupada avoided sitting near the Buddhists. He didn't want to be connected, because outwardly, Vaishnavas and Buddhists, the dress, you know, and hair, or lack of hair, is somewhat similar. But so Prabhupada didn't want anyone there thinking he's a Buddhist, so he wouldn't sit near them. He sat somewhere else away from them, to make clear the distinction. So that is there. But Prabhupada did that not out of fear of going to hell for so many kalpas, as Garuda Purana warns, but because of preaching. This is the Bhagavad Dharma. Bhagavad Dharma is preaching. Whatever we do ultimately is aimed at preaching through prachara, of course, as we are doing right now, speaking on the strength of Srimad Bhagavatam, but also our achara, our behavior, that is exemplifying how a Bhagavata, a devotee of the Lord, carries himself in this world, what he does not. So that is shown in Srimad Bhagavatam. The vichar, the going deeper into the philosophy, argument, debate on the basis of Shastra. Sometimes even, often vichar means between friendly parties. Prabhupada said this. When brahmanas get together to discuss some abstruse point, it is not that they're pounding their fists on the table, and pointing one another, accusing one another of being murk. You murk! You fool! You don't understand? No, but vichara means they go very deep into the subject matter and they consider it very deeply. So this is also on the basis of this pure asambandha gyan coming from Srimad Bhagavatam, vichara, and then upachara, worship of the Lord. So when we worship the deity, our prayer is not, please Lord, I'm giving you this incense and this flower. You give me nice new Mercedes-Benz SL 500 in return for this flower and stick of incense.
Very good exchange rate.
That's what they think. I give a little dupe, a little pushpa, and I'll get Mercedes and this and that, you see. That's how they're thinking. So this is materially motivated. And sometimes that is even, some tinge of that is even cropping up in the other sattvic Puranas. Some slight tinge of it. And so that is the distinction of the Brahma Sampradaya. Even before, it's interesting to note that even before Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the Brahma Sampradaya, even when Madhvacharya and his descendants, the Tattvavadis, were the sole guides of the Brahma Sampradaya, even then it was known as a Sampradaya of vast knowledge, and it was even then known as the Sankirtan Sampradaya, even then. Of course, they did their Sankirtan, they had Madhvacharya had composed many bhajans, and it wasn't a simple chanting of Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. Lord Chaitanya condensed everything down to this Maha Mantra, which is in itself a Vedic mantra, from, as you know, Kali Sutra and Upanishad. It was actually Mahaprabhu who took that mantra from the Vedas. If you have ever read Kali Sutra Upanishad, actually I happen to have it right here, by chance. It's just 11 verses. And you can see that the aim of that too, the aim of the Kali Sutra Upanishad, is liberation. Brahma is advising Narada that you chant this Maha Mantra and you will surely attain the different kinds of liberation. He mentions Swarupya Mukti, of course, but even Sayujya is mentioned, the merging. You can get that, or you can get Salokya to attain the same planet of the Lord, and I believe Samipya, not all five, but four, because two, I think, association with the Lord and sharing the Lord's opulence are sometimes, they're put together as one. Because if you're with the Lord, you're not going to be standing there in, you know, old rags in Vaikuntha. You're going to be outfitted appropriately as a personal associate of the Lord. And therefore it is said the residents of Vaikuntha look just like the Lord. So anyway, sometimes those two are put together. So he mentions four kinds of liberation and five can be derived from that. So that's as far as Kali Sutra Upanishad goes, up to liberation. But for a Bhagavata, Krishna actually declares in the ninth canto of Bhagavata, in speaking with Durvasa Muni, that my devotees are not interested. They couldn't care a fig for liberation. You see? They don't. That is actually a goal that devotees consider contrary to pure devotional service. So unlike you, Durvas, great sage, for whom everything is moksha, my devotees, they consider that insignificant, a distraction. So it was Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, even though the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra was already there in the Shastra. I remember going to South India once to... some reason we ended up in some Durga temple, famous Durga temple. And so there was all these Shakta Brahmanas around. And they saw us chanting. But they were very learned. And so they saw myself and the other devotees chanting something. They asked us, what is your mantra? We said, Hare Krishna mantra. Hare Krishna Maha mantra. Oh, very good. Kali Sutra Upanishad. They knew. Even though they weren't even Vaishnavas. They knew. Very good mantra. However they understood it, I don't know, but anyway. So this is the point. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took that Maha Mantra, which clearly in Kali Sutra and Upanishad is clearly declared as the only way to liberation in this age. There is no other way. That Iti Shodashikam Nam Nam Kali Kalmasha Nashanam, you can look through all the pages of the Vedas, you will not find any other way in this age for attaining moksha than by chanting Hare Krishna. That is clearly stated. But he has taken these 16 syllables, these 16 names of the Hare Krishna mantra, and he has dipped them in the nectar of Krishna Prema and distributed them. So you see, it's a special honey-soaked version of a Vedic mantra that only Mahaprabhu gives. So this is the speciality of this Bhagavatam, because it teaches the background of the Sankirtan movement, the philosophical background. Prabhupada used to always say that. We are not simply sentimentalist, chanting some, you know, simple rhyming mantra in the street like foolish people. There is background. And when he said there is background, he meant the Srimad Bhagavatam and the Sandarbhas of Jiva Goswami and the books of Rupa Goswami, Sanatana Goswami, all of this is further elucidations. Bihad Bhagavatamrita, Lagu Bhagavatam by Sanatana Goswami, Lagu Bhagavatamrita by Rupa Goswami, the Satsandarbhas by Jiva Goswami. They're all elaborations of this one Mahapuran, the Srimad Bhagavatam. So it's 9 o'clock. Anything to announce or pass out? Oh, they should turn in their essays. You should have brought back your essays, which were marked by me, and return that. Give this to Kashishwar, because we keep them on file. They're very helpful. All right? Anyone not bring their essay? Ha. Huh? You can bring it tomorrow, of course.
I have a question on this, because the way you wrote your essay was there were many, many references. But, you know, being a Brahmacharya, I don't just want to have these books that I can have these references, you know, Prabhu Shishamrita and, you know, the lecture in the Bhagavatam.
Well, then maybe I was showing the ideal form of an essay. Not that you have to come to that standard, but I was just trying to show how to use Shastra to back up your arguments. So I was impressed by your essay. I was impressed. You got special mention, as did several other devotees, because you drew from very simple sources, but you used them expertly. So that's the point. Not that it's necessary to draw from so many sides. But even if you have just three verses, if you can use them expertly, that's what we want to see. Support your arguments with logically, you see, Shastric sources that logically support that argument. You know, not some quote that it's very hard to see what the relationship is between this verse and what you've just said. That you did very well. All right, so please give your essays. Oh, I think we'll.